Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 8th of May, these are our main stories. While fighting continues in Sudan, it's confirmed that face-to-face talks have begun between the two sides. But with what chance of success? The Ukrainian capital Kyiv has suffered its fourth night of Russian airstrikes in just over a week. Also in this podcast, the United Nations has called on the Taliban to stop public stoning, flogging and execution. And the BBC has a new way of broadcasting, live from a bicycle.
Welcome to the Bike Bureau. This is like a Swiss Army knife for mobile broadcasting.
We start in Sudan, where increased fighting's been reported in the southern parts of the capital, Khartoum. And we're no longer talking about a straightforward battle between two sides, government and insurgents. There are reports of armed gangs now marauding and looting supplies. Hundreds of people have been killed since the conflict began, and more than 100,000 have fled the country. There have been several ceasefires called, but none apparently achieving very much. Formal talks have now begun involving the two main antagonists, the army and the insurgent group known as the Rapid Support Force. More of that later. But first, we hear from the neighbouring country, South Sudan, which many refugees have fled to. South Sudan is a relatively new country, which won formal independence from Sudan in 2011. And it's had plenty of troubles of its own. These now risk being exacerbated by Sudan's problems, as the BBC's Africa correspondent Catherine Buarahanga explained from the border town of Renk.
The mood here in Renk is really of a town trying to get to grips with the crisis that's unfolding on its doorstep. We have to remember that Renk and much of South Sudan has been at war over the last few years. The country is trying to transition from this through a political agreement and trying to bring this war to an end. Driving through the town, I saw vehicles of the National Army that had been attacked. There had been set alight. So you're seeing charred remains of vehicles. You see buildings that have the impact of bullets or shrapnel. And then this is the sort of town that people are having to flee to. In fact, many of the people who left for Sudan had been fleeing this violence as well. And here in the town, you know, one thing that's very, very difficult to find is accommodations. We and other media organizations have had to camp out in tents. The UN Refugee Agency in South Sudan really is tasked with helping refugees who usually have come in from Sudan over the last few years. And now they're having to support South Sudanese who are really coming in essentially as refugees once again. And I've been speaking to Gift Friday Noah. He's the Assistant Communications Officer for UNHCR in South Sudan. He told me this crisis came as a shock for many of them.
It is a crisis that caught people by surprise. And as UNHCR, we are very concerned because this is an unplanned influx of new arrivals on the dire humanitarian situation of South Sudan. If you look around, South Sudan at the moment is faced with the climate change, conflict, and food insecurity. So this has raised an alarm to the humanitarian actors in South Sudan as to how this crisis will be handled.
What do you do for these people? What does the government do to help them?
In Renk particularly, we have established this transit center in order to allow the onward movement of these South Sudanese returnees to their designated states. Most of them have expressed interest of going back to where they come from. Despite that, most of them have arrived into South Sudan, especially Renk. We have people who are inhabitants of Renk who fled here from in 2014 because of the conflict, and they have found that their houses are all destroyed and they have nowhere to go. So the UN agencies in South Sudan are working in collaboration with the government of South Sudan in order to see how best they can help these vulnerable people.
So you mentioned some people who want to go back to their ancestral homes in South Sudan. But that's a big challenge.
As the UN system, we have launched an emergency response plan this week, and we are asking for $96 million in order to help the government in facilitating the movements of these people from wherever they are in the different parts, different entry points into South Sudan.
That's a gift Friday, Noah, from the UN Refugee Agency, and all eyes here are going to be on those talks happening in Saudi Arabia.
Catherine Buerhanger. So what of those talks in Saudi Arabia? The two sides, the army and the insurgents, are supposed to be sitting down together. Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher is in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, where she's been following events. I asked her what the meeting of the two sides was hoping to achieve.
They're hoping to establish a humanitarian truce. This is not at this point about negotiating to end the war. So the aim is to get a short-term ceasefire in order for humanitarian aid to be delivered and for essential services to be resumed. The Saudis put out a statement this morning, talking about what was happening. They said that both sides were looking at security measures that they could put in place to make this possible. Not too much detail about what that would involve, but Sudanese officials have said they're thinking of opening humanitarian corridors in Khartoum and Omdurman, where a lot of the battles are taking place. Also about providing protection to civilian infrastructure like hospitals and health facilities. And of course, a mechanism to monitor the ceasefire, because without that, it wouldn't be successful. As we know, all previous ceasefires have been shaky, to say the least. The statement from the Saudis does say if they get this short-term ceasefire, they also want to then schedule expanded negotiations to achieve a permanent ceasefire. But then you'd also have to get to negotiations for some kind of arrangement to end the fighting. In order to get there, they'd have to deal with the issues that started the conflict, which was how their two forces would work together, so how they would integrate and what timeline there would be, and then who would lead them, so what the chain of command would be. And it's not at all clear that, you know, they're in any position to get even back to the point of talking about that. At this point, the RSF leader, General Hameti, his military position is around the presidential compound. That's his main target, so that remains his goal.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Ukraine's president has been in a typically defiant mood. Volodymyr Zelensky said evil would be defeated, just like the Nazis were defeated in World War II. He was speaking after another round of missiles and drones were launched at the country, hitting a food storage centre in the city of Odessa and causing damage in the capital, Kyiv. The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, visited a residential apartment building that was hit.
Right now we're in the apartment, one of the buildings. Today was one of the massive attacks to our hometown. 36 kamikaze drones fly to direction in our hometown. And thanks to anti-missile system, everyone was shot down. And five people was taking injuries, two people right now in hospitals. But nobody has died.
Our correspondent Hugo Bachega is in Kyiv and described to me the scene where he was.
Here, the air raid alert sounded shortly before midnight. It lasted for 3.5 hours. So again, residents were told to seek shelter. Again, this attack happened as residents here were sleeping. And the authorities say that all drones that were fired at Kyiv were intercepted. And I think, again, it shows how important the air defense systems have been here in protecting not only Kyiv, but cities and towns across the country. Now, the Ukrainian military said that all 35 drones, those Iranian-made drones that Russia has been using to attack Ukraine, were intercepted by air defense. But Russia also fired 16 missiles, and cities like Odessa, as you mentioned, but also Kherson, Kharkiv, Mykolaiv were targeted. And in the city of Odessa, a warehouse was hit. So again, Russia continues with these airstrikes. It was the fourth time in 8 days that Kyiv came under attack.
It felt like there had been a bit of a lull in this kind of attack. They didn't stop, but we didn't have this kind of ferocious barrage of missiles. I wonder if you could tell us why you think it seems just in the last week to have picked up again.
Well, I think the background to this is that the Ukrainians say they're finishing their plans for this much-anticipated counteroffensive. They've received the weapons, they've received the military assistance that had been promised by NATO countries, and now there is the expectation for this counteroffensive for the Ukrainians to try to take back territory that's now under Russian occupation. If you look at the map, nearly a fifth of this country remains under occupation. And perhaps this is the way that Russia is responding to this possible counteroffensive. And perhaps this is the way Russia is going to respond when this counteroffensive finally happens. So I think these attacks may be linked to the preparations of the Ukrainian military for this much-anticipated offensive.
Hugo Bacega in Kyiv. A gun amnesty has come into force in Serbia, just days after 17 people were killed in two mass shootings. The Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, has pledged to disarm the country, which is estimated to have one of the highest rates of gun ownership in the world. Here's our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delorni.
Last week's shootings shocked Serbia. A massacre at a school in Belgrade on Wednesday. Then, the next day, a second in a village not far from the capital. The country's president, Aleksandar Vučić, says he's taking practical steps to reduce the chance of any future attacks. He's announced an amnesty for owners of unlicensed weapons. From today, people may drop them off at police stations with no questions asked. A 2018 survey suggests there are 39 guns for every 100 people in Serbia, the vast majority unlicensed. The amnesty lasts for 30 days. After that, Mr. Vučić has promised harsh measures for transgressors. Police were stationed near all of Belgrade's schools as they restarted classes today. The government is planning to recruit more officers to be stationed at schools. This evening, opposition parties are staging a protest. They blame media outlets close to the government for promoting violence and crime.
Guy Delorni. Now, you're not supposed to get behind the wheel of a car when you're drunk. It's also illegal in most countries to try and drive under the influence of drugs. But what about when you have a lack of sleep? The latest evidence suggests that driving a vehicle on less than 5 hours sleep is just as dangerous as if you've had too much whiskey or wine. Researchers in Australia are now working on a test to measure whether a driver who's caused a road accident was sleep-deprived. The project's been run by Professor Claire Anderson from Monash University in Melbourne. She told Justin Webb how they're doing their research.
We've been running laboratory studies to try and to see if we can take a blood sample to determine how long somebody has been awake. And in a laboratory environment, we can detect if somebody's been awake for 24 hours with almost perfect accuracy.
And how will that lead to potentially prosecuting motorists who are too tired?
Well, we're not obviously doing this with the primary aim of prosecuting motorists that are tired. We think it's really important to develop new tools and systems to detect how long somebody's been awake. And one of those approaches might be in the context of driving. But also, they're really important for forensic analysis where crashes have already happened and blood samples can be easily taken. But certainly a future such as like a breathalyzer for alcohol, having that kind of test is much further away in the future, and much more work needs to be done before we reach that kind of test.
How come? What is the work that would need to be done if it were to be that accurate?
So in a forensic test, if we're just taking a blood sample, obviously that's a much more controlled test. We have time to be able to develop the blood test and send it off and make sure that we're confident in the result. In terms of a roadside test like a breathalyzer, it's a test that occurs in real time that you can't stop somebody on the side of the road and wait for hours for things to process. It's got to be a test that's less than 5 minutes in duration. It's got to be really highly accurate. This isn't a test that we can have any false positives if it's going to be used in the context, certainly in a legal context. So for us to be able to develop a test that gives us a real-time indication of how long somebody has been awake requires a lot of work in relation to making sure things like adrenaline isn't going to affect the test, making sure that we've got biosensors that can pick up the biomarkers that we've detected. So much more work needs to be done before we have a roadside test for sleep deprivation.
But as you said right at the beginning, it is hugely important, isn't it, that we do begin to understand when we are seriously impaired through lack of sleep.
Oh, it's so important. About one in five fatal crashes or implicating sleep in a causal factor. So we would say that drivers obviously have a responsibility to be safe on the road. They should be asking themselves how sleepy they feel, and if they feel sleepy, they should stop driving. But of course, people know this and people continue to drive. And so we have to look to a future where we have new ways of managing fatigue and new ways of showing drivers the dangers of sleep deprivation and being able to measure that.
Professor Claire Anderson talking to Justin Webb. Still to come.
I've never in my life seen so many fires. It's almost like living in hell because everywhere you look and see, there's a fire.
30,000 residents of Alberta province in Canada are forced to leave their homes.
15 years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martina Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, say what you like about the Taliban, they aren't perfectly straightforward about the methods they use. When one senior official was asked about punishments back in 2021, he said that chopping off criminals' hands was necessary to maintain security in Afghanistan. They just couldn't decide whether to do it in public. Well, apparently their verdict was that public amputations are fine. A new report from the United Nations says its use has been widespread, public flogging and stoning as well. They've called on the Taliban to stop this. I asked our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Ethirajan, what kinds of crime are being punished in this way.
According to this UN report, in the last 6 months, they're talking about 274 men and 58 women. They were being flogged in public for various offences. What they are talking about is drug trafficking, adultery, theft, fraud, kidnapping, and also including killing. So they are talking about a variety of offences, and some of those who go through are women, and many of them are accused of what they describe as running away from home without the permission of their parents, in case if you want to elope with somebody else against the wishes of the parents, then again you are subjected to various punishments. So this corporal punishment has come back quite strongly in the last 6 months. That is what the UN report says, even though during their previous rule in the 1990s the Taliban were executing people and giving this punishment. And now, in the first 1 year, they didn't see a dramatic increase or witnessing these kind of punishments. But now the UN says that it is increasing. So it is time for Taliban to stop it because this is against the convention of torture. So it must end immediately. But the Taliban, they say, you know, according to their own interpretation of Islamic Sharia law, these punishments were carried out under the guidelines, so they are necessary.
It's not just the United Nations. We know that other countries, other figures have condemned the Taliban for doing this. I mean, does the Taliban really care what its critics think?
But if you look at what the Taliban have been doing for the last 2 minutes, since August 2021, initially they promised that there will be a new version of Taliban and there will be more freedom. But then gradually they imposed various restrictions, for example, against women in working, as well as for secondary schools for girls. They have not yet reopened. And also they don't want to see many women in public places, for example, in gyms and baths. They have stopped. And there have been condemnation from around the world about the way they are trying to, what many people describe, remove women from public spaces. But the Taliban continue to impose, you know, new restrictions every day, even if the latest one being the women are not even being allowed to work in most of the areas in the United Nations agencies within Afghanistan. In fact, there was a special meeting by the UN a few days ago in the Qatari capital, Doha. So with these imposing these punishments, the Taliban seem to be gradually putting back their own rules and regulations despite international condemnation.
And Barasan Ethirajan. Britain's coronation celebrations are still going on, more parties, more singing and dancing. But it's not just Britain that the newly crowned king reigns over. There are 14 other countries which have Charles III as their head of state, a legacy of when they were British colonies. Among them is the small Caribbean nation of St. Kitts and Nevis. But now the country's prime minister has indicated they want this to change. Dr. Terence Drew told the BBC his country would never be totally free while King Charles III reigned over them. Our correspondent Celestina Olulode has this report.
St. Kitts and Nevis is one of eight Caribbean countries where King Charles is still the head of state. It's a tiny nation with around 50,000 citizens, but it's now reconsidering its relationship with the monarchy. I spoke to Dr. Terence Drew, the country's prime minister.
The head of state still reside in the monarchy of England. And so that aspect of it is telling us that, and we have to admit it, that we are not totally free yet.
A public consultation needs to be had in all of this. When is that going to happen?
I can tell you that that consultation or discussion will start sometime during my leadership. Every country in the Caribbean that is presently under the monarchy is asking that question.
Next, I asked about reparations, a form of justice for the descendants of enslaved Africans, which could include formal apologies or forgiveness of national debt.
We call it reparatory justice. So it's not just about money. It is about really changes even within the systems that are still affecting people of African descent in negative ways.
What would you like to hear from King Charles?
Acknowledging that something would have gone wrong, something wrong was done, that acknowledging it and apologising for it is a step in the right direction.
Buckingham Palace says slavery is an issue the king takes profoundly seriously. Last month, the palace said it was supporting independent research into the royal family's historic links to the slave trade. And as to whether countries should consider becoming republics, King Charles has said that it is a matter for each nation to decide. Spectators' eyes are glued to the pitch at this cricket match. Britain's influence remains strong here, right down to the choice of national sport. But even after almost 40 years of independence, there's ongoing debate about this nation's identity.
People here are still mentally enslaved. That's why I think that becoming a republic would just benefit our people more.
Debates like this are happening right across the Caribbean. Several countries are already pushing hard for a transition away from the monarchy. But whatever happens next, both Britain and its Caribbean realms are headed for a painful reckoning with their past.
Celestina Olulode with that report from Sidon Kitts and Nevis. Almost 30,000 people have been evacuated from the Canadian province of Alberta as unprecedented wildfires rage across the region. This is said to be due to abnormally hot weather and high winds, but also quite possibly due to the lack of resources as firefighters have been struggling to contain the disaster. A state of emergency has been declared. Andrea Schmidt is a resident of Edmonton, the capital of Alberta. She told the BBC's Rob Young what the situation was like.
In all my years living here, I've never in my life seen so many fires. Like it's almost like living in hell, because everywhere you look and see, there's a fire. Like surrounding the city, there's fires. Inside the city, there has been fires. Houses have been on fire. It's just like it's unbelievable, to be honest with you, because like I said, I've never seen this many fires, especially in our city.
How do you cope then, living in that situation? Did you have to get out of your house?
No, this one here, they managed to keep that one under control. And then they put it out. And then a couple of days later, it actually restarted. So it is actually, it's very triggering for a lot of people. You know, I do a really good job on maintaining my personal mental health, but I know a lot of people aren't coping very well, especially since now we have over 30,000 people that have been evacuated due to wildfires. We've opened up a center for people to be able to go to, but as for the surrounding areas, there's really not much places for people to be able to go. I mean, they're telling us not even to drive on the highways. So how are people supposed to, you know, get to where they need to go to, which would be Edmonton, if we're not supposed to be driving on the highways?
So what is causing all of these fires?
This really, you know what, that has been a huge question that's been running through my mind. And we have had unusually warm temperatures. We've had a massive heat wave hit us. So plus 30 temperature is something unheard of, basically. 30 to 50 kilometer an hour winds day and night. Normally, we still have snow on the ground. We've had so many fires. It can't all just be, you know, from somebody throwing a cigarette butt out the window.
Andrea Schmidt in Edmonton, Canada. If you're a regular listener to BBC Radio, you may have heard us say that we're joined live by someone sitting in a radio car. That's a vehicle which is specially adapted, usually with an aerial sticking out of the roof, and other equipment inside which allows people to broadcast. Well, two of our team have created a more environmentally friendly version of that. Kate Vandy and Anna Holligan have produced a broadcast bicycle. It's made out of a cargo bike, one of those large ones designed for deliveries. And it allows them to do solo-operated and solar-powered live reports. Anna Holligan gave us an audio guide to her two-wheel transmitter.
Welcome to the Bike Bureau. This is like a Swiss Army knife for mobile broadcasting. It contains all the kit we need for news gathering, interviews, and to provide TV, digital, and of course, radio lives on our phones, transmitting around the world. It's our innovation, and it's designed as a pragmatic and sustainable way to carry out our mobile journalism. We hope you will find this inspiring, because actually using this bike is revolutionizing what we can do, how long we can do it for, and it allows us to take you to the heart of breaking news in a climate conscious way. We've chosen the Netherlands as the perfect place to pilot this project, but actually it's also where it originated, because it was a few years ago, Kate Vandy and I were recording a documentary, Europe's Cycling Revolution, and we saw how cargo bikes were real game changers in enabling people to conduct their kind of work and life in tandem. We also have witnessed the climate impact. Already, I have racked up 10,000 kilometres on my bike while working, which has massively reduced my emissions. It's also meant I can get rid of my car, no more parking or petrol costs. But we think there's a potential to do so much more. This is just phase one. We're hoping the Bike Bureau will help the BBC to achieve its goals to become the world's greenest broadcaster among them. Editorially, we'll be using the Bike Bureau to focus on solutions and track down positive stories and tech developments that could transform all of our lives and have a positive impact on the environment. But that's not all. We really want you to be part of this journey. So if there are any stories you come across that you think the Bike Bureau should be covering, then please do send them our way. You can find us at Bike Bureau on Twitter.
Anna Holligan. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Davith Evans and the producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnussen went missing after a night out with friends in London.
I wonder what on earth could have happened.
We were so obsessed with just finding her.
Then,
police investigating the murder of a Norwegian socialite in central London.
Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. His name is Farouk Abdelhak. He's never been questioned by the police. Nobody's been able to speak to him until now.
It got me like feeling a little bit sick to my stomach. I've never been open.
I'm Noelle McAfee, and I've been following this story since Martina was killed, making a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. You can listen to the whole story now. Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.